Constitutional Conversations with Dr. David Gray Adler are presented by the Alturas Institute and KISU-FM. Find audio for this and other Constitutional Conversations, complete with question and answer portion of the program, on our website. Visit KISU.org, click on Programs, and find Alturas Institute Events.
It's great to have you all here. Thanks very much. I want to thank KISU for broadcasting this program and for the support from all of our very generous sponsors. And very happy to have all of you here to engage in what I think will be a very interesting topic. The word interesting covers a lot of ground. Joining the Army can be interesting. This is one of those topics that will serve to spark a great deal of discussion and, as you know, controversy across America, and it has for at least a century or so. And you know that when we talk about church and state, particularly the issue of separation of church and state, origins and controversies, that we're plumbing the depths of constitutional arguments that often divide Americans and set various regions to quarreling. And certainly scholars have engaged in a great discussion about what the founders meant by those two great phrases in the First Amendment of the Constitution: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And so it's very much in our interest to come to grips with what the founders of the First Amendment had in mind and to try to understand the nature of the arguments across the decades. So tonight we want to begin by examining what the framers of the Bill of Rights had in mind when they wrote the First Amendment and included these very broad and specific protections for religious liberty. We can start by acknowledging, of course, that the framers of the Bill of Rights had no particular ranking in mind when they framed the various provisions 1 through 10, but as it happens, they actually wrote 12 provisions for the Bill of Rights. But the first two were rejected by the states. After the first Congress wrote and passed 12 provisions, the states failed to pass the first two. One had to simply deal with the size of representation in the various districts around the country, and the second had to do with the prevention of the raise of salaries for members of Congress so that they couldn't win an election, turn around, and vote themselves a huge pay increase. Who would think that Congress would do that? Those, of course, that second one, the pay raise that I mentioned, did take over 200 years before it was ratified. That was one of James Madison's prized contributions. And so undoubtedly he would be happy to see that it took 200 years for his idea to finally catch on. Or we might say it differently. It took 2 centuries for Americans to catch up with James Madison's ideas. It's a little bit better. Given the fact that those two proposed amendments were defeated, it meant that what would have been the Third Amendment now became the First Amendment. And while all of our rights are precious, no single right is superior to what becomes the first guarantee, and that is protection from laws respecting an establishment of religion. Why would that be so important? The first thing we would say is the very fact that the prohibition on laws respecting an establishment of religion is swollen with symbolic significance in our time, but particularly in the time of the founders. Why? Because any reference to that phrase, laws respecting an establishment of religion, rang the changes on fears among those who were very much committed to religious liberty, because it conjured in the memories of people across the century a historical association with tyranny of an established church, with the tyranny of an established religion. Because if it meant nothing else, that phrase, laws respecting an establishment of religion, signified a union between a government and a church. And of course, we are very familiar with the fact that in England it was the Church of England. In many other countries, there would be no freedom from the official church and the government. In various European countries, often it was the Catholic Church. Now, the idea of a union, of a legal union between government and religion, undermined the very concept of religious liberty, because our founders knew that there could be no equality of opinion for all the diverse religions if there was a presence of a law respecting an establishment of religion. In European countries, that phrase had a very particular meaning. It signified an official church, a national religion, the Anglican Church, the Church of England. And thus, when many fled European countries, including England, to come to the shores of what would become America, they did so because they were deprived of religious liberty. There could be no religious liberty unless you were a member of that official church. And so those who fled religious persecution in America, in Europe, were hopeful that they could establish religious liberty here in our country. Well, many fled religious persecution, but unfortunately, what happened up and down the eastern seaboard and to some extent into the colonies was that religious persecution continued. It meant that people were not so much opposed to religious persecution, they just didn't want to be on the wrong end of the stick. What amounted to religious persecution in various colonies was pretty simple. People could not run for office or vote unless they belonged to a church, unless they tithed to a particular church. Some colonial laws attempted to be magnanimous. Oh, you can choose the church that you want to tithe to, but you have to tithe to a church. So what happened to those people whom we would describe as non-believers? They were forced to pay to support churches, even though they didn't embrace church doctrine or the religious doctrine. What about those who were not Christians? Jews, for example, or Hindus and others who would not subscribe to Christian doctrine, they too were required to pay a tithing. What these practices represented then were an exercise in laws respecting an establishment of religion, or to put it in simpler terms, laws concerning religion, laws touching on religion. All of these practices then were the very kinds of practices that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison railed against in 1786 when they combined to write and to lead to the enactment of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. The Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom becomes the model for our First Amendment to the Constitution, because the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom prohibits the coercion that was so characteristic of colonial practices, the requirement that people had to pay money to support a religion, that they had to tithe to a particular church. The Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom reflected the views of Jefferson and Madison that government should stay out of the business of religion, that it should be pushed to the sidelines, so to speak. Why did they feel this way? Because they thought religion was a personal matter. They would never stand in the way of the choice that people would make to participate in religion, but government should be no part of that business. 2 years before that, in 1784, James Madison had worked hard to defeat the General Assessments Bill in Virginia, which would have replicated the colonial practices that so outraged many people, requiring people to pay to support a particular church, that the state of Virginia or the colony of Virginia could impose a religious tax on people and people would be required to pay. So Madison, just a very young buck at that time, in his 20s, who was mentored by Thomas Jefferson, took out his pen and began to rail against the general assessments bill. And it was in this legislation that we get a very clear view of James Madison's view on what constitutes religious freedom. Religious freedom could not be obtained if there was a governmental requirement that people had to pay taxes to support religion. That would constitute the very definition of tyranny. Madison went on to say that the true measure of the popularity of a given church lay in the fact that it could be self-sustaining, that there would be enough parishioners who believed in the teachings of that church, that they wanted to pay to support it. If, in fact, a church could not stand on its own two legs, so to speak, that was a sign that there simply were not enough people willing to support it. And under no circumstances should the government step in and promote religion, aid religion, support religion, because Madison believed that would be grossly unfair to people, because that would be coercion to support religion. And why? What would be so fundamentally wrong with that? Because Madison, like Jefferson, believed very deeply in freedom of conscience, that religion was, in fact, a very personal relationship between an individual and God, and there was no role for government to play. So when he was fighting against the General Assessments Bill, he was proclaiming to all who would hear or all who would read his work that, in fact, there should be a separation of church and state. Separation of church and state to protect religion from government and also to protect government from religion. What an interesting characterization. To protect government from religion. Where in the world would James Madison have dreamed up this idea? The reality is he didn't dream it up. He had read about it. In the 16th century, the great Italian philosopher Machiavelli had written a tremendous book called The Prince, which became, unfortunately, a guide for many authoritarian, even totalitarian leaders in the 20th century, because it would describe to the prince or any person who wanted to acquire power how to acquire it and then how to keep it. And this is the very dark side of the prince, in which was closely read by, among others, Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini. And the idea in this book was, do anything necessary to acquire power. It's okay to steal. It's okay to lie. It's okay to carry out violence. And if it's necessary, a little murder once in a while is okay. Machiavelli did not believe in what he was writing, but he wanted a job. This becomes a resume. It was so well done that when Machiavelli submitted the prince to the ruling clan in Italy, the Medicis were so impressed that they locked him up because they saw in Machiavelli a brilliant philosopher, and they said, somebody that brilliant should not be allowed to be on the streets. Throw him in jail. That's what Machiavelli's The Prince is really known for. But inside this book, when he's talking about the nature of politics, politics and religion, he is complaining that those who are true believers, those who believe that the earth is just a way station on the way to heaven, are not the people who should be involved in politics. Why not? Because true believers always have their eye on the next world. They have their eye on heaven. They won't be those people who are truly committed to problem solving on this planet, the here and now. So he said, we don't want them in politics because, in fact, he said that true politicians will eat them up. That real politicians are wolves, the true believers are lions, and most notably, he said, the true believers will corrupt politics because they'll be looking at the next world. So on this point, Machiavellian is arguing for separation of church and state because religion will corrupt politics. A century later, Martin Luther, who launched the Protestant Reformation, and we're in the celebratory year now, obviously argued for separation of church and state because he complained that the Pope, Pope Leo, was selling indulgences so that people could get passes to heaven. And when Martin Luther observed what he perceived to be Pope Leo's corruption of religion to serve political ends, he exploded and argued for separation of church and state precisely because politicians were corrupting the purity of religion. Keep politics out of religion. These two great philosophers were widely read by our founders, and you see the coalescence of that teaching found in James Madison's writing, his complaints about the General Assessments Bill in 1784 and reflected again in 1786. Don't mix the two. Keep them separate. They were not the first in America to argue for separation of church and state. Roger Williams, for example, who wrote very eloquently about the beauty and the virtue of religion, was talking about the need to separate church and state as early as 1644. And others during that same period, a century before Madison and Jefferson, were using that phrase, the teaching of which was culled from Machiavelli and Martin Luther. Jefferson would go on to explain in writing and supporting the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which, remember, becomes our First Amendment, that history reveals that whenever government is meddling in religion, that we see freedom of religion overwhelmed by politics, overwhelmed by the government, that the best way to ensure that religious liberty will flourish is to keep government out of that realm. Because the moment government comes into the realm of religion, that's when we see the elimination of religious liberty for those who do not subscribe to the official church, to the official doctrine. And thus there can be no religious liberty. There can only be a particular church, which would be denominated the true church, the true religion. And what happens in that kind of environment, in nation after nation in Europe, is those who would not subscribe to the official doctrine would be labeled heretics. What happens if you're a heretic? If you're in Spain, you suffer under the imposition of the Inquisition. You might be burned at the stake because you're a heretic. So what happens to freedom of conscience? It's eclipsed, says Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson will go on to write famously that in his observation of history, more people had died in the name of defending God than any other single cause in world history. Because across Europe, people would go to their deaths fighting for their own religious doctrine. That's the essence of the 100 years war in Europe. When the Peace Treaty of Westphalia was finally signed in 1648, it provided borders in Europe, but it provided, it was hoped, an end to these religious wars. Didn't succeed, but it reflected the fact that leaders were trying forever to try to end internecine fighting grounded on religious teachings. So Jefferson, in writing the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom in 1786, he hoped that this would spare Virginia, which he referred to as his country, and America from the very kinds of horrors that had been inflicted on Europe. So as in so many other cases, when we look at the writing of our Constitution, the drafting of particular provisions and clauses, we see that they reflect the framers' widespread and keen study of history. They didn't write from a blank sheet. They were eclectic, to be sure, but they were very learned in what other countries, what other generations had done to address questions that were of an enduring nature. So here comes the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. It becomes our model for the First Amendment effort to protect religious liberty. How does this work? You may recall that in the last days of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, in September, just 2 weeks before the framers closed the door, before they adjourned on September 17th, that some people in the convention said, our work here is not finished because we have yet to include a Bill of Rights. The Constitution, as it's proposed, looks pretty good, they could say, but where is the Bill of Rights? Where are the protections for the great magisterial rights that we have come to enjoy in our states and come to expect as children of God, some would claim? Where is the protection for freedom of speech? Where's the protection for freedom of religion? We find no protections for those great magisterial rights. Leaders of the Constitutional Convention, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Ben Franklin, among others, responded by saying, we don't need a Bill of Rights to protect a great freedom like freedom of religion or a great liberty like free speech. Why not? Because, they said, examine the document. Look at Article 1, which would refer to the powers that Congress would enjoy. You do not find any grant of authority that would allow Congress to meddle in the area of free speech or freedom of religion. So long as there's no positive or affirmative grant of power for Congress to legislate on the issue of religion, there's nothing to fear here. Without a grant of authority, Congress cannot legislate on religion. And those leading framers would go on to explain that our Constitution moves by the grant of affirmative authority. Well, that had an appeal on a logical basis, but the opponents of that view, those who still wanted a Bill of Rights, said, wait a minute, that's not enough protection, because we look at one of those clauses called the Necessary and Proper Clause, found in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 18, which provides, quote, Congress shall have all power necessary and proper to pass laws, to carry into execution its foregoing powers and the powers of the other departments. And those who wanted a Bill of Rights said, we see potential mischief in the Necessary and Proper Clause. We see, for example, the possibility that Congress might decide to pass a law to create an establishment of religion. Where is the protection for us if Congress decides to pass a law respecting an establishment of religion that might impose taxes on us the way the colonies and the states did, or might require us to tithe to a church? Where's the protection? So those who wanted the inclusion of a Bill of Rights were the very people who were warning that Congress might legislate on the area of religion, that Congress might pass a law that would touch upon or would respect or would otherwise concern religion. It didn't matter that people like James Madison and James Wilson and Alexander Hamilton, the heavyweights in the Constitutional Convention, we're saying if no affirmative power is granted, then Congress can't legislate. That was falling on deaf ears. It was at that point where Madison and the boys realized that if this proposed Constitution was going to become the law of the land and replace the Articles of Confederation, that they had better yield. And so Madison said, okay, if the proposed Constitution is ratified by the American people, I pledge to introduce a Bill of Rights. And he did do that. On June 9, 1789, true to his word, he introduced the proposed Bill of Rights. By the way, a little trivial point. He won an election to the House of Representatives, but he had to defeat a guy named James Monroe to do it. The same James Monroe who would later become president. Folks, as voters, how would you feel about having a choice between Madison and Monroe? Not a bad choice, as choices go. Madison introduces then the Bill of Rights, and what he introduced as the Third Amendment, which becomes the first, as we know, because the states would later defeat it, he includes those phrases to protect religious liberty. He includes two phrases: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, what did Madison and company have in mind? What they wanted to do was to create an inviolable right to practice religious liberty. Even though they did not rank the rights, as we've said, there could be no freedom if there was not at least protection for for freedom of conscience. That's what Madison was pounding away at. There had to be protection for freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience, then, would allow people to exercise their beliefs in a higher power. They could choose to be a non-believer, but their conscience would be protected. They might be a Christian, and their religious liberties would be protected. There would be protection for Jews and Quakers and Hindus. That was the way forward to protecting religious liberty. Now, how to accomplish that? The Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are essentially two sides of the same coin. The best way to guarantee religious liberty, the free exercise of religious liberty, Madison believed, as we said earlier, was to keep government out of the business of religion. Thus, the Establishment Clause, which was written in the most absolute language that anybody could muster on a page, said Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That meant Congress could not write any law affecting, concerning, respecting religion, keep government on the sidelines when it comes to religion. If you keep government on the sidelines, then there would be no governmental power to interfere with the free exercise of religion. Now, that would not guarantee an absolute right to practice your religious liberties as you see fit. What it does do is to confer an absolute right of freedom of conscience. You're free to think your thoughts, to hold your beliefs, to think about your relationship with God or the universe. Of course, there would have to be restrictions on the exercise of religion, just as every other amendment in the Bill of Rights is subject to some regulations. The question always would be what constitutes a reasonable regulation, and that's when we begin to see arguments, and we'll talk a little bit about those tonight. So the framers then of the First Amendment believed that those two clauses, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, would run in harness. The goal was to promote and to protect religious liberty. One of the arguments against separation of church and state in modern times, despite statements, for example, by Roger Williams or Thomas Jefferson in a famous letter to the Danbury Baptist praising the separation of church and state in the First Amendment, or James Madison's appraisal about the quote-unquote perfect separation of church and state that the founders had written into the First Amendment. One of the objections to that view, voiced particularly beginning in the 1960s and moving forward, reflected in the views of some, like the Attorney General Ed Meese, who served under President Reagan, or the former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, was the view that all the Establishment Clause did was to prohibit the establishment of an official church like the Church of England, or to prohibit the establishment of a national religion, and that it would be permissible under the Establishment Clause for government to aid and promote religion so long as it didn't single out a religion, a particular religion or a particular church, for preference. So people like Ed Meese and William Rehnquist then believed that the Establishment Clause could still permit, would permit, governmental aid to religion, support for religion, assistance, and promotion, so long as there was not an official church or an effort by the government to single out for preference a particular church or religion. What can we say about that historical approach, which of course is embraced by many across our nation? The first thing to say, if we're just speaking about Chief Justice Rehnquist, was how odd it was for Rehnquist to squeeze from a prohibition on Congress the expansion of a power. How do you see in a strict absolute prohibition the availability of a power on the part of Congress to enhance, assist, or promote religion? That's quite an intellectual feat. That would be an act of magic, you'd have to say. How would I back that up? We'd back it up, number one, by citing Jefferson and Madison and Roger Williams and others talking about the high wall separating church and state. We would also say that of all the members of Congress who voted, who wrote the First Amendment and voted for it, nobody in that Congress advocated the right or the authority of Congress to pass legislation to promote or assist religion. Nobody did. So, folks, if we have a strict textual prohibition, Congress shall make no law, and if we have a clear, empirically based evidentiary statement in the form that nobody in Congress ever advocated for governmental assistance of religion, it's hard, even if you're William Rehnquist, it's hard to squeeze from a prohibition on power a source of power, and indeed an expansion of power. So that view, often characterized as the non-preferentialist school, because all that is prohibited, in their view, is government identifying a particular religion or church for aid or assistance. If you don't do that, then government would be free to assist or promote or aid government as long as it's not singling out a particular church or religion for that assistance. If what I've just told you then stands the test of scrutiny, then we would ask, how has the Establishment Clause, and later in a few minutes, the Free Exercise Clause, how has the Establishment Clause been interpreted over the course of our history by the Supreme Court, and what kinds of issues have ignited controversies that have roiled American politics? Let's start with school prayer, official prayer in America. In 1962, in a case called Engel versus Vitale, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to a New York law which reflected the writing by the New York State Board of Regents that set aside a moment every morning in public schools where a school official, a teacher, a principal, an assistant principal would lead the children in prayer. It was supposed to be a non-denominational prayer, and in many cases it was, but some parents challenged it, saying that it violated the Establishment Clause. Why? Because it constituted, almost in a perfect way, governmental assistance of religion. Why? Because the state owned the schools, it's state-owned property. The state was promoting prayer, maybe the purest way of practicing religion, at a time when children were required to be in the school because of compulsory education statutes. And the prayer was being promoted by state officials who were paid through state tax dollars. So the parents thought, this is a gross violation of the Establishment Clause. When the case came before the Supreme Court, Justice Hugo Black wrote the opinion striking down the statute on grounds that it violated the Establishment Clause. And he wrote in a long historical discussion that the founders had intended to create a high wall separating church and state. Here was Justice Black invoking the very rationale that the framers thought that religious liberty, which was the great aim of the First Amendment, would be promoted rather than stifled if government were pushed to the sidelines. That the clearest way to undercut religious liberty would be to give government a role in religion. But he said that's not what our framers did. Our framers, he wrote, had a broader view of what constituted a law respecting an establishment of religion. To repeat, in England and in Europe, that phrase was limited to the establishment of an official church, signifying an official legal union between government and religion. In America, however, our conception of that phrase, laws respecting an establishment of religion, had a broader meaning and a broader application. It would apply to any law that in one way or another promoted, assisted, or aided religion. So the court struck down school prayer, and you may know in 1962 when this decision came down that many Americans were outraged. The court became the target of many people who believed that the court was trying to kick God out of the classroom. And so bumper stickers appeared on automobiles that said, "Impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren. Put God back in the classroom." The truth of the matter, however, was that God was never evicted from the classroom because children would be free to pray at any time in the classroom under the Free Exercise Clause. All that was prohibited was the utilization of school officials to orchestrate or guide or otherwise lead the prayer. That's what was prohibited. School children could still pray in the classroom. Throughout my years of teaching at the university, I had a number of students who prayed before exams. I don't know if it helped them, but they did it. They were acting on the basis of the Free Exercise Clause. But many in the public misunderstood what the Supreme Court had said in Engle versus Vattel. And it wasn't just a misunderstanding, it was the decision was deliberately distorted by people who were opposed to the ruling, people who wanted school teachers to lead a prayer. But from the standpoint of Madison and the founders and others who embraced that view going forward, there would be nothing particularly said about a school teacher that would qualify a school teacher to lead a prayer, to lead an exercise in religion. Rather, that was a private matter following the teachings of Matthew in the New Testament. It's a private matter. After Engle versus Vattel, the politics and the political rhetoric were ratcheted up around the country, and school prayer became an issue for every election, for every official from the federal to the state, to the local level. And people running for city council and the county commission and the state legislature, Congress, and the presidency invariably would be asked, where do you stand on the issue of school prayer? The Supreme Court to this day has upheld Engel versus Vattel, despite the fact that many candidates running under the banner of the Republican Party or denominating themselves as conservatives would vote on the Supreme Court and lower federal courts to uphold the essence of that case, Engel versus Vattel. In a case in Alabama in 1985, the Alabama legislature was trying to be a little sneaky, trying to circumvent Engel versus Vattel, trying to bring school prayer back into the classroom. The Alabama legislature voted in the passage of a state law to say, we are going to set aside a moment of silence at the beginning of every school day when, the legislature said, children could utilize that moment of silence to pray or meditate. The use of the word pray was recognized then by people who challenged the statute as an effort to put school prayer back in the classroom. When the case reached the Supreme Court, the court struck it down on grounds that, in fact, if you look at the legislative history surrounding that bill, that is the debates in the state legislature, that many state legislators were saying, this is how we're going to get school prayer back in the classroom, thus clearly, deliberately trying to circumvent the decision. If the state legislature had simply said, we're going to create a moment of silence and stop there, then undoubtedly the law would have been upheld. So it was an interesting case where politicians couldn't simply be satisfied that they could create a moment of silence. They were pushing their agenda to overturn Engel versus Vattel. But this decision was not the decision of liberals. It proved over time to this day to be a decision that has been embraced by both so-called liberal and conservative justices. It remains for many in the country a hot button item, and you'll hear from time to time people running for office saying, let's put school prayer back in the classroom. The question for our audience is just how far does this extend? Well, the reach of this decision has very few, if any, limits. So consider a few years ago in the state of Texas, where religion is dominant, but that would be football. Organized religion is the second religion. And in the state of Texas, there was the effort to set aside a moment where the cheerleaders and other students could come around the flagpole and recite a prayer that would be led by a school official over the loudspeaker. They thought, well, this is just all voluntary. The Supreme Court struck it down, again on the grounds that you're using state property, state officials, state dollars to promote religion. The teachings then of Madison and Jefferson and the others on the virtues of keeping government out of religion, I think, are reflected again and again in the decisions of the federal courts. Bearing in mind, always, that students can, in fact, pray silently, by themselves, softly, by themselves, under the Free Exercise Clause. The Establishment Clause cases, then, which we could follow if we had another 6 weeks, provide really interesting readings, but we'll stop there. The other clause, the Free Exercise Clause, has been profoundly interesting to Americans as they've tried to grasp what the court has said about that great clause. That is the goal, to promote religious liberty. And when the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of thereof, we wonder, what is the scope of our right to actually exercise our liberty? We know that you have full, perfect freedom of conscience, but when you try to put your religious liberties into effect, then that may collide with other values in our system, and then limits have to be drawn, lines have to be drawn. So, for example, if we look at a couple of cases in the early 1940s, we saw the court weigh in its first significant way on the scope of religious liberty. So consider in 1940, in a case called Minersville versus Gobitis, the court had before it a statute in which the state had provided that all school children would be required at the beginning of the school day to salute the flag as a means of promoting patriotism and the school district believed promoting national security. So the kids are saluting the flag, but the Gobitis kids, who are Jehovah's Witnesses, refuse to salute the flag one day because that religion teaches that its members should not salute a graven image, and the flag was a graven image. So the parents instruct the Gobitis kids, don't salute the flag. When they don't salute the flag, you can imagine what happens in the classroom. The teacher says to the Gobitis kids, why aren't you saluting the flag? Well, it's a graven image. Our religious doctrines tell us not to do it. So we're practicing our freedom of religion. Predictably, the teacher sends the students to the principal's office. Principal quizzes them. Kids explain. Goes to the local school board. The school board suspends the Gobitis kids. Now, what just happened to their freedom of religion? They want to live in accordance with their freedom of religion, which tells them don't salute the flag. The litigation ensues, goes all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1940, the Supreme Court upholds the mandatory flag salute. It upholds the compulsory flag salute statute. What was the reasoning? Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote the decision saying that it's important for the court to defer to the state legislature because we want legislatures to make public policy in this country. And even though there may, he wrote, may be a violation of religious freedoms, sometimes freedoms have to be sacrificed, particularly at a moment like this, he said, because war clouds loom over Europe. America may be drawn into the war. And if the legislature decides that one of the better ways to protect and to promote national security is for five-year-olds to salute the flag, then the court should defer to the state legislature. He was very sensitive in writing this opinion because he was Jewish, and he said, listen, a person like the writer of this opinion, who is a member of the most tormented, persecuted religion in the history of the world, knows a little bit about persecution. And the fact is that Jehovah's Witnesses who are required to salute the flag will simply have to grin and bear it because national security is at stake. There were a couple of dissents in that case accusing the majority of its insensitivity toward religious freedom. So we would stop and ask ourselves at this point in time, what's the scope of religious liberty if on grounds of your fundamental religious teachings, you cannot refuse to salute the flag? Stay tuned. Right after that decision came down, a couple of the newer members of the Supreme Court, Justice Hugo Black and William O. Douglas, admitted to the public in a subsequent opinion that they had made a mistake. They regretted their vote. The same issue comes back then in 1943. This time, Justice Robert H. Jackson writes the majority opinion overturning the 1940 case, upholding the right of students to refuse to salute the flag, not only on freedom of religious teachings, but also freedom of speech. And Justice Jackson, in one of the most eloquent frames of an opinion ever produced, drew an analogy between the requirement in the United States that school children have to salute the flag and what was occurring in Nazi Germany. What was the difference between saluting the flag and saluting the Führer? He went on to explain the essence of religious liberty. And he said that the great difference between a constitutional democracy, such as America has, and a totalitarian system like that in Germany, was that here in America, there is a little inner sanctum of the mind that is off limits to government. We have a little corner of our mind where the government can't go. That is where we have absolute freedom of thought to determine our relationship with our maker or the universe. Freedom of thought, which is absolute. The government cannot enter that area. Government, moreover, cannot be the final word on what is conventional when it comes to religious teachings or political teachings. If the day comes when the government is going to say that people need to believe this and that in order to be good Americans, that would mark the end of our constitutional democracy. That becomes the law of the land, and it ends the practice of the compulsory flag salute statute, and this represents a great victory for religious freedom. But the question of how far we can, as I say, practice our religious liberty is a matter of great moment, has always been a matter of great moment, and it is now. If you consider the premier freedom of religion case before the Supreme Court right now, which will be resolved by the court by the end of its June term at the latest, involving a man in Colorado who bakes cakes for a living, he owns a bakery, who refused, as you know, to bake a cake for a gay couple in celebration of their wedding. He did so on grounds of freedom of religion. He said, "My religion teaches me that same-sex marriage is abominable. It's abhorrent. I don't want to be any part of that." When he refused to sell to make a cake for the gay couple, he was held in violation of the Colorado statute against that prohibits discrimination, including discrimination against members of the LGBT community. The high court in Colorado upheld that lower court ruling, and so the appeal was made to the Supreme Court. The high court in Colorado upheld the anti-discrimination statute, and in the body of the opinion reminded people that the exercise of freedom of religion is still limited, particularly when it collides with other constitutional values. And here there was an exercise in fairly recent American history. People in the 1950s and 60s in America refused services to African Americans on grounds that their religion told them that somehow African Americans were inferior, didn't deserve to be served at their stores or their shops. And the Supreme Court, of course, struck down those laws in states that permitted individual shop owners to deny their services to African Americans, essentially rejected the ruling that freedom of religion can be used to deny service to African Americans. The Colorado court then drew a parallel to discrimination against African Americans and discrimination against members of the LGBT community. That's the issue that's before the Supreme Court. Right now, it's caught a lot of attention. The defenders of the baker will say that religious liberty includes the right to refuse service to those whom you believe are violating your religious beliefs. That if you are forced, or in their language, coerced, into baking a cake, then you are participating in practices that you find abhorrent, and your religious liberty protects you against it. The other side says, however, that going back many, many years, whenever you hang out a shingle to be to be selling your wares, to be selling your products or services, that you have to abide by all the laws governing shopkeepers and those who will sell various products, including anti-discrimination statutes. So here, we could at least say we have a conflict of constitutional principles if you accept the argument that religious liberty, in this case, can be converted into a sword to ward off those with whom you don't want to do business. Against the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits states from passing any laws that deny the equal protection of the laws. If the cake baker happens to win, if the Supreme Court upholds that argument, then one wonders what will be the effect across the country. You can imagine many people creating arguments that their own religious views would be violated if they're forced to sell flowers, to sell cakes, to even serve members of the LGBT community, and then we would be left to wonder what happens to the equal protection guarantees under the 14th Amendment. My own prediction is that the Supreme Court will, in fact, uphold the Colorado ruling, will rule against the cake baker because of the impact on the nation if, in fact, the cake baker were to win. But it's a fascinating case because it pits two fundamental values against one another. The question of the scope of religious liberty on the one hand against the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And as people have said, even if you have to bake a cake for some people you don't like or who have political views or religious views or other kinds of views and values with which you disagree, doesn't mean you're supporting those views or values. You're just baking a cake and collecting some payment for your cake. It's very likely that as far as the eye can see, that we're going to always have lots of questions and a great deal of litigation about the meaning of the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. It could hardly be otherwise as people cling tenaciously to their own religious teachings. And it's hard to think that it could be otherwise in a very polarized system such as ours now, where in fact the government is going to be encouraged to promote particular religious values of individuals or organizations that are well-funded, and candidates running for office are going to want to fight those battles because that money is so critical to their longevity in office. Justice Antonin Scalia, often viewed as the patron saint of conservative jurisprudence, in fact did say in writing opinion striking down an Oregon law that in fact, in upholding an Oregon law that prohibited the use of peyote during a religious exercise, he said, "No man is a law unto himself. You cannot use religious liberties as a shield. You cannot use your religious liberty as a sword to refuse to obey generally applicable laws, laws applicable to everybody else." So when admirers of Justice Scalia, who would support the cake baker, and others who would refuse to serve members of the LGBT community on religious grounds, think about it, they would perceive a conflict between that justice that they most admire and what they're advocating. That would require them, at a minimum, to back away from invoking Justice Scalia and to find another hero whose views would be more amenable to their own. It seems to me that when you think about all the views and values espoused by the founders on any part of the Constitution, that the wisdom they employed in writing the Establishment Clause remains as powerful, maybe more compelling in our time than even in their own time. the wisdom behind the creation of a wall separating church and state has probably in many ways helped to spare America from the great religious battles that have engulfed European countries, other regions of the world, the Middle East, for example. And so it seems to me that Jefferson and Madison were probably a little bit helpful to us. Thank you. Now, as I always tell my students, whether in political science or law school, when we study the cases involving the religion clauses, you're often walking into a quagmire, because in some cases it's been hard to find a rhyme or reason to what the Supreme Court has ruled. But I'll be happy to try to answer any questions with that waiver of reliability. Yes, please. So we have a question. So, Greg, you have the microphone. Thanks.
Hi. I don't remember if this was a law that was passed, but the law saying that medical people didn't have to, that they could refuse service to people. Mm-hmm. What's the deal with that?
That which people could refuse to give
medical service? The doctors
medical
and
people.
Nurses people.
Yeah.
And pharmacists.
Very. So here's a good question that has application given the outcome of this cake baking story. If, in fact, the cake baker is relieved from any obligation to provide services to members of the LGBT community, where would it stop? Why would it not include pharmacists and medical personnel? Would it include teachers? Who would not be enveloped within that category? And if, in fact, the court were to rule in favor of the cake baker, we could begin to see two very different societies created in America. Some people say, well, if you can't get the service you want from this cake baker or that physician or this pharmacist, just go down the street and find another one. That was the argument used during the 1950s and the 60s during the rise of the civil rights movement. That's not the issue, of course. The real issue is there a legal ground to refuse service for doctors, for pharmacists, for nurses, cake bakers, photographers, florists, etc. Not unless you want to have a very polarized country operating under two very different systems of values. Yeah. Where are we, Greg?
Yes, one of the rituals of American life is to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yes.
And there are two items in there that actually caused me a little problem. And one of them is, of course, the allegiance to the flag, which you just talked about, the saluting the flag issue. And the other one is One Nation Under God. Now, I know all these things are more recent. They're not 200 or 300 years old. But maybe you want to comment about those.
Thank you. Those are good questions. So when we look at language invoking God, for example, on our coins, in God we trust, I'm really poor, so I haven't seen any money lately. But recollection is that language appears, the motto, in God we trust. The Supreme Court has described the dollar bill utilizing that motto as an exercise in quote-unquote ceremonial deism. That the court says nobody attaches any religious significance to those words. Now, that kind of ruling has offended many around the country who take that language very seriously, but the court has dismissed it as lacking religious significance. And let me just try this out on you. If you go to a movie and you hand over the dollars that include that motto, do you say to the clerk taking your money, "I give this to you, in God we trust"? Do you bring a hushed voice? Do you summon Charlton Heston? Can you summon James Earl Jones? I don't think so. If you put a dollar in a machine to buy some soda, actually you probably have to put a lot of dollars in these days, nobody believes in the solemnity that the language suggests. And thus the court has said that there is no religious significance because nobody believes it that way. Now, I've just said that many are offended by that. So what would that lead us to ask? We would ask, first of all, why did Congress pass legislation to include either "In God We Trust" or, as Arthur just asked, what about in the Pledge of Allegiance, "One Nation Under God"? That language was inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s during the height of McCarthyism, when the United States is engaged in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. And the thinking of Congress was this: if we insert our allegiance to one God, that will favor the United States, give us a leg up over other countries, those that follow the godless atheist communists, then surely more nations will come to the United States in terms of being under our watch, under our blanket. We would win the hearts and minds of people around the world. So it was instilled only for the most cynical political reasons. So those are good questions. I'm glad you asked. Do you have a follow-up to that? Let's see. Hang on. Can you hang on? Because Greg is 40 yards away. Can we come back to that? Okay. Pardon? Under God. Okay, thanks. It'll be fun to tackle that in just a second. Yep. Please, where are you, Greg?
I had a question about taxation of churches. Mm-hmm. Whether there's ever been any cases that have gone up to the Supreme Court on that issue, or what the legal standing is for that.
Very good question. The answer is yes. And so we might say that going as far back as the founding, when the policy was adopted by Congress and states, I should say state legislatures across the country, not to impose taxes on churches, what was the thinking? The thinking was that if taxes are imposed on churches, that would interfere with the free exercise of religion. So that probably represents our biggest bow to religion, to organized religion, by not levying taxes, providing that tax exemption. Now, of course, given the rising role of religion in American politics, there are many who will say that churches ought not to receive that tax exemption because they're engaging in politicking, in lobbying, and so forth. Well, that sets off a major argument that really, in many ways, takes us back to the arguments that distinguish Machiavelli from Martin Luther. Some people will make the argument that, of course, we want religion in the public square. We want religious arguments in government to improve the morality of government, to reflect the rights of all Americans to be heard. Others will say you can do that in your own individual capacities, but not as an organized religion. And so that argument is heating up, and it too becomes, you want to remember that the question of the role of religion or churches in American politics often becomes a question of great political moment, because those seeking office want to be on one side or the other as a means of raising money. So President Trump, of course, campaigned on the theme of protecting the religious liberties of churches by allowing them to practice in politics. And you know, he wanted the law repealed that prohibited the contributions by churches to candidates for office. Whether he, I guess we can't question his sincerity, because he said that, yes, I did say that, because he said that, it must mean that he truly does want the laws changed so that churches and other religious organizations can participate in the political realm through contributions. Of course, that would raise a question of their tax-exempt status under the IRS. Congress would have to change a number of laws to effectuate that. Thank you for that question. Dave.
So you said that you felt like the Supreme Court in June would rule in favor of upholding the Colorado statute. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it will be a split decision, with Kennedy tipping the scales again? And then a quick other question. Could you touch on maybe a moment about Gorsuch replacing Scalia? Do you think it's a even trade ideologically, or is it a sort of a lateral move, or is he more extreme, less extreme? What do you maybe just talk for just a moment about that?
Thanks. Two great questions that look inside the Supreme Court. So on the first question, if in fact my prediction is correct that the court will uphold the Colorado decision and essentially reject the cake baker's argument, where does that mean that Justice Anthony Kennedy will have played a crucial role? I think the answer is yes. Justice Kennedy, of course, has built a well-deserved legacy as writing the critical Supreme Court opinions upholding and advancing the rights of members of the LGBT community, going all the way back to Lawrence versus Texas in 2003. So as many court watchers have observed, if he did not rule in favor of the Colorado statute, he would essentially be rendering an opinion or casting a vote that would repeal his great legacy. And nobody seems to believe that he would do that. And I certainly do take the view that his standing on the Equal Protection Clause and the 14th Amendment protections for members of the LGBT community have been consistent and will be consistent again in this case. On the other issue, you ask a very nice question. Justice Gorsuch, of course, replaced Justice Scalia. Is this an even trade across the board? That's a very good question. A lot of people ask that. I think it's too soon to tell, only because Gorsuch has been on the court for such a short time. But one way to evaluate this over time will be to ask, will Justice Gorsuch be willing to strike the blows struck by Justice Scalia on religious freedom and the ability of a state to prevent people from using drugs just because they're doing it in a religious exercise when it's criminally prohibited by anybody else, meaning there is no preference for religious believers when they're going to use drugs. Will he be willing to go there? Will Justice Gorsuch also be willing to very vigorously protect freedom of speech when it's opposed? For example, in the flag-burning case in 1989, Texas versus Johnson, Justice Scalia joined the opinion written by Justice Brennan, the most liberal member of the court, in upholding the right to burn a flag on grounds of free speech, and the vigorous, powerful, emotional dissent was written by the Chief Justice Rehnquist. And everybody thought, at least up until that point, that Rehnquist and Scalia were two peas in a pod. That was the point where they diverged, because Scalia was more committed to free speech. Yet, as you no doubt know, many conservatives in the country are appalled when the American flag is burned. They would call it un-American. There should be no constitutional protection. I recall that when presidential candidate Donald Trump was interviewed, he said those who burn the flag should be sent to prison and should be stripped of their citizenship. Well, there he was breaking from the Supreme Court justice that he claimed to admire more than any other. So you ask a really good question. We're going to have to wait and see if that is how that trade, so to speak, works out over time. Thank you. Oh, back to ceremonial deism. What's the question?
Well, I just want to tell you something that happened at Bonneville High School. Mm. They had an assembly, and the assembly required the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay.
And the person setting up the assembly said, and don't leave any words out.
Hmm.
Now, that's a violation of church and state, and it's a violation of freedom of speech.
I agree completely. There would be no authority at the school that could require the recitation of all of the words. You're exactly right about that. I don't know if that constitutes treason or not. Treason seems to be gaining a new meaning, a new definition in America today. One before I take this quick question, if you talk about the defense of freedom of conscience and religious liberty in its highest form, consider in a three-minute historical tour here the status of the conscientious objector status. In World War I, when people did not want to serve, they were drafted but did not want to serve, they were and claimed a CO status, conscientious objector status, they would be granted that status only if they were members of a religion that actually taught pacifism as one of its principal religions, the Quakers, for example. So if you're a Quaker and you didn't want to participate in the war, you would be granted a CO status, the Supreme Court said. But notice the bias against other people who might have different reasons, philosophical and religious, for not wanting to participate in the war. They could not receive a CO status, even though a Presbyterian or a Catholic might have an equally valid objection on grounds that they thought war was wrong. So there was a bias. In World War II, the Supreme Court loosened the standards a little bit and would grant a CO status so long as the person claiming the status, asking for the status, could say that they had a religious basis for asking for a CO status. So a broader application, but look at the lack of fairness toward an atheist, for example, who would not be able to invoke a religious status but might be equally pacifistic as any member of an organized religion. In the early days of the Vietnam War, the court loosened the standard even further to give greater deference to freedom of conscience, and it said those seeking a CO status are entitled to it so long as they have a belief that war is wrong that is akin to a religious belief that war is wrong. So that's a looser standard, but what about those people who simply did not believe, did not have a religion, didn't believe in a religion, and might want a CO status for philosophical reasons? A couple of years later, in 1972, the Supreme Court heard a case involving a person who wanted a CO status, but said to the court, I don't have a religious basis for this. I'm not a member of a religious organization. I just cite it on historical and philosophical reasons. I think war is wrong. The Supreme Court upheld the right of that person to a CO status and said, and here was the key, so long as that person has a, quote, sincere belief that war is wrong. With that ruling, draft boards across the country shut down because there was no way for draft boards to know if a person asking for a CO status was sincere or insincere. That knocked it down. So there was an original idea rooted in religious liberty that finally at the end hailed freedom of conscience. Please.
Well, I'm an old person, so I remember school prayer pretty well. And I went to elementary school in a school that you pass if you drive on Highway 33 up toward Driggs. So many times I heard the Lord's Prayer recited by a student who had a shaky grasp of the words themselves and of the meaning of the words. So I often heard, "Lead us now into temptation." And it's had a profound effect on me. So, just offering that. But my question is, who decides what is a church or a religion? Is it the IRS that gives them the tax-exempt status? Say the Church of Scientology. How did they get to be a church when they actually don't perform any of the traditional functions of a church? What's a church and who decides?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in part, it's the IRS being asked whether to grant an exemption, or it can be a court to determine whether or not a small group of people have risen to the level of being a church or a religious organization. So 20 years or so ago, there was a group of individuals that wanted to engage in actions with deadly snakes, and the state prohibited them. They claim First Amendment rights as a church. The court ruled that you're not an organized church. So you don't have a First Amendment right to engage in these acts with deadly snakes, at least on religious grounds. So sometimes courts will decide, sometimes, and of course the IRS can make a determination, and if the IRS rejects the claim for First Amendment religious status, then often there'll be litigation, so ultimately the courts would decide. The Supreme Court and sometimes lower federal courts will often put themselves in positions where they're making very important determinations on religious freedom. So, for example, in 1878, in a famous polygamy case involving the LDS Church, the claim was made that on religious principles, the LDS Church should be able to practice polygamy. The court ruled against that assertion by saying that even if there's going to be a claim of religious liberty to practice what was perceived to be a fundamental doctrine, that was going to be disallowed because it collided, the court said, with great public policy concerns, which is to say the justices of the court didn't think it was appropriate, morally speaking, for a man to have 25 wives. And so we're going to talk about that case in some more detail next week when we return for what I think will be a popular program, The Constitution and Love. We'll see. Where are we? Right here? Please.
So it seems that in all of these cases, each party seems to lose a right or more. Will there ever be an opportunity where we'll reach a middle ground where we won't lose?
So sorry, excuse me. Our favorite train is right here.
Fine.
And so your voice is colliding with the train, so to speak. Could you start again, please?
Of course.
I appreciate it.
So that seems in all of these cases, each party seems to lose a right or multiple rights. Will there ever be like a middle ground, or will we eventually get to that point where the entirety of our rights are never maintained?
Okay. So I still didn't hear that very clear. I think there's an echo back here.
I have it written down if you want.
You have it written down?
Yeah.
Okay. So please read that again.
Okay. I will try.
Okay. Thank you.
So it seems that in all of these cases, each party seems to lose a right or more. Will there ever be a middle ground where both parties don't lose one of their given rights, or will we eventually get to the point where the entirety of our rights are never maintained?
Great question. Thank you. So the third time's the charm, right?
Yeah.
So Alice in Wonderland, if you say something three times, it must be true. So thank you. So litigants go into court believing that their respective positions are right, the other side's wrong. Sometimes one of the parties to the case will win on all issues. Sometimes the court will have to strike a middle ground and decide to create a policy based on law that meets some of the interest of both parties. So there are two examples that come to mind. Thank you. So in that second flag salute case that I mentioned, one of the reasons why the court in the second flag salute case struck down the state statute requiring kids to salute the flag was because it involved not only a religious liberty claim, but a free speech claim. It wasn't just we have the right as a matter of religious liberty to refuse to salute the flag, but also we can't have the government requiring us to salute because that infringes on freedom of speech, right? And in the Colorado case involving the cake baker, at the first level, at the first go-around, the cake baker was simply arguing religious liberty, but by the time he now filed an appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States, he's added free speech, making the case a hybrid case. Hybrid cases tend to fare better before the Supreme Court. Here he's combined freedom of religion and freedom of speech. But your question's a good one, because in almost any opinion, the Supreme Court is setting forth a policy that will reflect a variety of values, but there's still going to be somebody that wins and somebody that loses, yeah. Good question, thank you. Way all the way in the back?
Yeah, that's right. So earlier we were talking about how the government cannot define what a religion is, but what prevents people from abusing that right? For example, my uncle was talking about creating a nonprofit or a religion with one member, that's him, and then he donates all of his assets to it and then can write those off as tax without paying taxes on those. Yeah. So how does the government prevent forms of abuse and fraud like that?
That's a very good question. So in a lot of ways, the court itself has to decide what constitutes a genuine religion. And so we would ask the question, well, what if we ask ourselves that question, does a genuine religion require, for example, honoring or praying to a single god as opposed to several gods? Ancient religions, of course, prayed to several gods. Is that, if you're not praying to a single god, does that mean you don't have a real religion, right? So that's one way, but the courts have to decide what constitutes the essence of a religion. And so on occasion, you get these kinds of creative claims. Lots of benefits to creating one. Where are you, Greg? We have a follow-up over here.
Oh, hold on.
So I guess the follow-up to that is it possible for the government to try to eliminate these fraudulent cases, or do they just have to let it go? One thing you could do is you could say, well, for it to be a real church, you have to have a certain number of members. But then how do you deal with, I don't know, kind of fraudulent churches like the Church of Scientology, which is kind of bogus, but they're doing the same thing, but they were big, they had members. So how do you fight that, or do you just accept it?
Well, that's a very good question. Both your original and your follow-up questions are very good. The answer tends to be arbitrary in some cases, because why should it matter if you have one member or 100,000 members? If you're going to practice your religious liberty, it would seem as though you ought to be able to practice your liberties in accordance with your teachings in your particular location, as you see fit. If you can't do that, then you obviously are going to be stirred to action and will say you're being denied your religious liberty. The strength isn't in numbers, is it? The strength would in some way be rooted in sincerity, to go back to the conscientious objectors case. But how are courts going to decide that? There have been courts that have decided that if religious groups are praying to multiple gods, that's not a genuine religion. But why not, when ancient religions did in fact worship numerous gods? So you ask, and so why did the court in the Reynolds case, the polygamy case involving the LDS Church, decide that in fact religious liberty would be stunted to the point where it could not extend to a man marrying multiple wives? Why? What about that? Well, the answer is the court thought it was immoral. So that means the justices, in the name of rendering an opinion which say a religious practice violates public policy, means, wow, go chase that. It's an ambulance. We'll hold the door. Do you have a card? Do you have a card? That, in fact, just lost track for a second. Inevitably, it brings in the justices' own values, both religious and moral values as well as legal values, always open to change. And you may know that there are cases coming up the judicial pipeline in which people are saying that polygamy should, in fact, be upheld and protected under the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause. The court would be invited, now I'm getting into next week, but the court would be, this is just a tease, you see. The court would be invited to consider elements of public policy. Is this going to, will it be exploitation of women, for example? Those kinds, that kind of a question, among others, would be raised. Good question, thank you. Where are we? Back, and then Greg, let's come down here, please. Thank you. Yes?
So my question kind of relates to his, actually. It has to do with how churches nowadays not all of them, but some of them are acting more like businesses than actual churches, like mega churches or the Church of Scientology, where some people actually have to spend thousands of dollars to get to God, and they still don't get taxed, but they're making millions and millions of dollars. Would you say, since they're much closer to being a business, but they involve God, that they still shouldn't be taxed? Or since there's any sort of God involved, that they still shouldn't be taxed?
Well, that's a very good question. So one solution would be for Congress to pass legislation to distinguish a bona fide, that is a legitimate church, from others that are really, in your words, a business masquerading as religion to gain financial advantage. Members of Congress are reluctant to do that. As you might imagine, because they don't want to be accused, of course, of being anti-religious. They don't want to alienate voters who might not even agree with the particular teachings of a particular religion or church, but will often sign on in the name of religious liberty. And that happens a great deal in our country, that individual churches will support other religions, even if they disagree with their views, in the name of religious liberty. So I see that we're out of time. One more question. Do we have one more question? Where are we? Right here, please, right in front of me. And then we'll use this as the final question, unless we don't.
So this is kind of in the same vein as some of the other questions, but there's a case that I was reading about in, I believe it's in Missouri, where a woman was coerced into watching a sonogram of the fetus and everything before she had an abortion, and to read specific, and it sounded like it was kind of religious-oriented mm-hmm. material. So there's actually two things that I was kind of curious about on this particular case, and one of them is the fact that she is being represented by an organization that is saying they're a religious organization. They in their public announcements or whatever portrayal, claim to not believe in any supernatural deities. But her argument is that it's against her belief that life starts at conception. And I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about that case, or
or not that particular case, but the general kind of conflict that you're describing often will pit state laws designed to protect the mother, the health of the fetus, against religious claims, and so these are the kinds of issue disputes that are driving a lot of cases through our judicial system. And in many of them, they are inspired by some religious doctrine or teaching or another. Because if you're arguing against abortion, for example, and you couch it on the grounds of freedom of religion, then you'll almost always get standing in a court so you can challenge the law or challenge the policy at issue.
Well, part of it too is, the organization that is fighting for her is the Satanic Temple, and that name, in and of itself, could tend to bias jurors or whatever. And
certainly could.
You know, how dangerous is that?
It certainly could have that effect. That's exactly right. So that's what is one of those fascinating parts of freedom of religion that goes back to a couple of other questions. When, in fact, is a religious organization entitled to protection under religious liberty? And the first question would have to be, is this really a religious entity? And then if the court decides, well, a particular church is deserving of protection, why not a satanic temple? So it puts the court in the position of trying to decide what constitutes a genuine religious organization worthy of protection under the First Amendment. Good question. All these are great questions. Thanks very much for coming out tonight. I hope you'll come back next week, and which we'll examine the Constitution and love, in which we take account of the Supreme Court cases that have involved interracial marriage, same-sex marriage, the constitutional right of married couples to use contraceptives, and a number of other clauses in the Constitution involving romance and love on the night before Valentine's Day, just to give you an extra opportunity to celebrate. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.